This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you are old enough to have gone to school in the 1950s or early 60s, you may remember duck and cover drills. That's when kids practiced getting under their desks in case of a nuclear attack by the Soviet Union. The government even put out films to help people prepare.
It looks something like this. There is a bright flash, brighter than the sun, brighter than anything you've ever seen. If you are not ready and did not know what to do, it could hurt you in different ways.
Critics said films like that did little more than scare people. But the question of how to respond to a nuclear explosion is getting new attention these days. This week, the National Academy of Sciences held a workshop on the topic, and NPR's David Kestenbaum was there.
As you might expect, this was not a cheery gathering. But on the bright side, the Cold War is over. No one worries anymore about thousands of megaton bombs wiping out the country. No, the concern now is a single, much smaller bomb, like the one dropped on Hiroshima. Till Jolly with the Department of Homeland Security tried to set the tone.
There are those who would like to do this to us. Is it likely? I don't know. I don't know if it's likely. It's one of those things that 0% if it doesn't happen, and it's 100% if it does. And I think we owe it to the nation to do the most we can to prepare for a potentially catastrophic event. So I want to thank all of you.
If your reaction is, I can't think about a nuclear attack, it's just too unthinkable. Well, you're not alone. Cham Dallas at the University of Georgia has given hundreds of lectures. Often, he says, people's eyes glaze over.
That glaze factor is stunning. And I'm talking about physicians and nurses and experienced planners. I almost feel like you have to use humor or something to break through it, do a Seinfeld routine or something, just to get through to people to where they'll listen.
Brooke Buttermeyer, a radiation safety specialist at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, put up maps from computer simulations showing what would happen if a Hiroshima-type bomb went off near the White House. The surrounding blocks get pretty much vaporized, but outside that zone, like, say, here, a mile away at the National Academy of Sciences, buildings and people could survive.
Fortunately, when I look at this building, it looks pretty solid to me, unless that's all fake. Hopefully we've got at least 12 inches of wall, and maybe 24, which means we're actually doing pretty good.
Buttermeyer noted dryly that he would have been killed. He was standing next to a window where he wouldn't be shielded from the initial radiation blast and where he'd be hit by broken glass. In fact, windows would break several miles away from the bomb. But there is that region, a sort of gray zone outside the area of total destruction, where thousands and thousands of people would need medical care. Injuries from fires, fallen buildings, radiation. Buttermeyer says few states and local communities have coordinated response plans.
I get a lot of, oh, if a nuke goes off, that's the feds, right? We just step back and wait for them? Well, I hope not, because decisions made in the first few hours and actions taken in the first few minutes have the most critical life-saving capabilities.
Hospitals would be overwhelmed. Colonel John Mercier with the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute said doctors need to be trained to assess quickly who is savable and who is not. He suggested giving out colored wristbands.
Clinicians have to have the moral courage to understand they cannot devote all their attention to just a few patients, and they're going to have to decide, you know what, we don't have the resources for this person or that person, and move on. That's the hard part.
Farther from the blast, there would be the danger of radioactive material carried by the winds. Fred Mettler is chief of radiology at the New Mexico VA healthcare system.
Early fallout is very, very radioactive. It sort of comes down looking like salt.
But Mettler says in a couple days, the material loses a lot of its radioactivity, and there are simple things people can do to protect themselves.
Staying inside where it can't drop on you, or if it has dropped on you, changing your clothes and washing is really may save your life at the end of the day.
I asked Mettler what he thought the best response to a bomb would be, and he said defuse it before it goes off. The final slide of his presentation showed an American flag and two words, good luck. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
A capital city usually means globetrotters, diplomats, foreign journalists, corporate executives, all speeding from one first-class airport lounge to the next. But as Dan Charles reports, in the capital city of Honduras, Tegucigalpa, the jet set has lost its jets.
Tegucigalpa's airport, called Tonkontin, is awfully quiet these days. Right outside the front door, beat-up old Toyotas are squatting in the special parking lot once reserved for diplomats. The life went out of this place on the 30th of May, It was a rainy morning, and one Airbus jet overshot the runway. It crashed through barriers at the edge of the airport and landed on a nearby road, crushing three cars. Norman Garcia, Honduras's former ambassador to the United States, survived without a scratch. He climbed out of an emergency exit and onto the plane's wing.
I walked, you know, along the wing. I said, it's too high here, so I walked all the way to the tip because the jump was about a couple of feet, so I jumped. I walked a couple more meters to the sidewalk. I turned around and said, hey, what a cachimbazo.
He's still amazed that only five people died, three in the plane, including the pilot, and two in the cars. What followed was almost as shocking. The president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, banned big jets from Tocantin. He said it was too dangerous, the runway too short, and the mountains around Tegucigalpa too close. The decision left the city's cosmopolitan classes feeling stranded. Now, when World Bank officials or international aid workers want to leave the country, they have to find their way to Honduras's second city, San Pedro Sula. That means cramming themselves into little commuter planes or going by car, a four-hour, nerve-shattering dash down a winding two-lane road jammed with trucks and old school buses. Norman Garcia.
It is amusing. It is funny. I mean, do we have to go to San Pedro, the way to San Pedro? You got to be kidding.
The Honduran president has proposed another answer. In a few months, he says, international flights can start landing at a military airport only 40 miles from Tegucigalpa. But Norman Garcia and many others don't believe it's going to happen. And anyway, because of the bad roads, it still takes 2 hours to get to that airport.
Believe me, it is very complicated. We're going nuts in Tegucigalpa.
So Garcia, even though he almost died at Tocantin Airport, wants to get back on that short runway.
Let me put it this way. Tocantin is an old friend. I have landed in Tocantin more than 600 times, I guess. I mean, the first time I landed in Tocantin must have been in 1953.
And he really expects to land there again. He's betting money on a face-saving compromise. The government, he predicts, soon will let the big jets land there again, just not in bad weather. And once again, he'll be within a few hours of Miami or Rio. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.